Hello, everybody. We get to be the nomadic organization, so there's always a joy in sharing another institution's fabulous space. So thank you, Peter, for hosting us here tonight. So PHS has been in a really busy time of exploring and planning our future. And we've used our bicentennial upcoming in 2027 as a prompt to plan against. And we really asked ourselves the question, by 2027, what is the change that we want to have made in the world? And we've spent really the last 18 months trying to answer that question. But before we started, Ken and Teresa Wood and I talked in a variety of ways and really thought about the importance of understanding where we've come from before we really decide where we want to go to. Because as a really old organization that still hums with the energy of a startup, we need to see ourselves as on a long historical continuum. So Teresa and Ken Wood were willing to invest in this project to really create the first really good scholarly history of the Horticultural Society. And Ted Most was willing to make it happen. So at this point, our future is pretty clear. We've adopted our Vision 2027 strategy, which really challenges PHS to be the nation's and the globe's leader in using horticulture as a force for social good, connecting people to one another, creating healthy living environments for everybody, and increasing access to food and economic opportunity. And we're going to do that through all the tools we have at our disposal. The Philadelphia Flower Show, which is the nation's largest and one of the world's largest horticultural events, our network of public gardens and landscapes in Center City and the region, our work in more than 250 neighborhoods around this region, and our partnership with home gardeners of all stripes who are part of the society as volunteers, members, and supporters. And our goal is through all those platforms to put horticulture to work to advance the greater good. So with that clarity of the future, I'm going to turn it over to Ted, who's going to take us through the past. And Ted Most holds his MA from Temple University Center for Public History, where he's recently been an adjunct instructor in the history department. He's written several scholarly papers on the cultural significance of historic house museums and is currently associate director of the Elfris Alley Association. So with pleasure and gratitude, just thanks again to Teresa and Ken Wood for making this happen. And I saw you and now I lost you. Over here. Thank you. And now gratitude to Ted. So take the stage. Thank you.
Thank you to Matt for that lovely introduction. Good evening. Thank you for coming. I have been extraordinarily lucky to spend most of the last year on and off working on this project. Up a little bit? Okay. Is this a little better? How's it in the back? Speak up? Okay. I'm getting a lot of over there. Okay. I've been working on this project for a while, and I'm excited to share much of what I found with you tonight. I did write a much longer paper, so I will be picking and choosing some highlights rather than reading 80 pages to you. With that said, they might not, some of the lines of continuity may be a little harder to read in the sort of hopping around. Okay, I was not working from nothing. There have been histories of the society written in the past. There was a centennial history written by James Boyd in 1929. In 1977, at the sesquicentennial of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, Edwin Peoples wrote a booklet, which actually I think it's pamphlet length, but it's a really good history of the organization. So I was working from both of those. I had a lot of help. Librarian Janet Evans and archivist Penny Baker were both very helpful in this quest. Thank you both. And lots of scholars have touched on PHS from different angles, kind of. There are some good histories of community gardening that could not be complete without a mention of PHS. There are some works about vacant land use that also were very helpful. Finally, there were also some oral histories that I was able to use, some of them conducted in 1994 upon what was considered the 20th anniversary of Philadelphia Green, and some which were conducted in the last year by Barbara Dundon. All of those sources were very helpful. Thank you to those of you who pointed me to them. I think Matt gave us a really good introduction into why a history of an organization like PHS is important. One of the things I found valuable was that tracing PHS through various eras of Philadelphia history taught me a lot about Philadelphia. By being centered on one organization, but trying to find the context in which that organization was operating, I learned about periods of the city's history that I did not know about before. So that was personally valuable to me. But also, as Matt alluded to, understanding an organization's past gives us a sense of its momentum. It tells us how we got here. It tells us where we're going in some cases, or at least it provides a tool for that. Okay, so I could start in a lot of different places with this history. I could start with the Ice Age. I could start with the Lenape. I could start with Swedish settlers farming the land that is now the city of Philadelphia. I could start with William Penn. Many people have. But I want to start by trying to highlight some of the sort of root materials that then became PHS. So let's get this started here. Okay, so this is John Bartram. Okay, John Bartram, before the American Revolution, built a successful business buying and trading seeds from North America to elsewhere, and from elsewhere to North America. His records tell us what plants were introduced into this area at what time. He kept great records. He died in the middle of the Revolutionary War, but his son and other plant collectors kept up his work. Their work was complemented by what men known as seedmen who sold seeds. Among these were Bernard McMahon, and these seed shops served as an area for conversations about horticulture, sharing that kind of information. If you take the collectors, you take the seedmen, throw in a couple institutions like the American Philosophical Society, and by the end of the 18th century, Philadelphia was considered a hub of horticultural know-how, such that when Lewis and Clark were sent to explore the Louisiana Purchase, many of the materials they collected, you might say plundered, were sent back to Philadelphia and distributed to many of those same people, the APS, the seedmen, other plant collectors such as William Hamilton. So that's one kind of component to the world that PHS was created in. Another is a culture of voluntary societies. One of the things that Peter alluded to is that the two organizations putting on this event tonight are both membership organizations. Philadelphia has a long history of these. Because Philadelphia was created with an absentee ruler, essentially, in William Penn, and because it was a colony with religious freedom, this city and this colony lacked some of the structures that made a monolithic culture elsewhere in this country. Jess Roney's book, Governed by a Spirit of Opposition, is a really good look at how the very things we think of as public services in Philadelphia today were often first started by voluntary organizations and out of some kind of competition. The Quakers would make a school, the Anglicans would make another school. Hospitals, poor relief, elder care, all of these things were built that way in Philadelphia. And when we get into the early 19th century, this city experienced another burst of these societies, of these institutions, for a lot of reasons. In the wake of the War of 1812, this country experienced what it called the era of good feelings. And this meant that there was an effort to establish the country's sort of sense of self and avoid partisanship. So there was this centrist culture, a lot of organizations that were seen as apolitical. Whether they were apolitical or not is another question, but they were seen as apolitical, were created, and they gave people of a certain class, people who had some money to spend generally, or who had some power in society, a way to find belonging and a way to create social networks. So both the Athenaeum, as well as the Academy of Natural Sciences, there were some reform societies, such as the Institute for the Deaf and Dumb was created in 1821, Historical Society of Pennsylvania, 1824. It was a very fertile time for creating new societies, many of which continue to exist today. And as with the guest list today, many people were members of multiple organizations. Another component of that gentry class in the 1820s was that many of them owned land outside of the city, and many of them gardened. Many of them had small farms. And so a time in which improvement, promotion, were the buzzwords of the day was combined with powerful people who were gardening, created some organizations that sort of melded those two. So, well, that's the Lewis and Clark. Missed that. So here we have the logo for the Philadelphia Society for Promoting Agriculture. This was an organization begun in 1787, I believe. Fuzzy on that date, but while some scholars have said that gentlemen who were trying to go back to farming were a reaction to the industrialization of the early 19th century, some folks, Eric Stojkovic is a scholar that comes to mind, have argued that really they saw their work on their villas and in their farms as cutting-edge work. This was forward-thinking work. They were solving the problems of a young nation. The PSPA did things like offer prizes for people who could offer a solution to the Hessian fly that was destroying crops across the country. They saw a way to put capital against a problem and get some sort of solution. The PSPA had the problem of many of these organizations. They wanted to serve a public, but they were not the public necessarily, and there was a gap between the people who were writing these things and doing some research on their farms and the people who were actually doing, providing food and more widespread agriculture. So in 1827, PHS starts, sort of joins the club of clubs, and this was the object. Today we might say the mission statement from the 1827 Constitution. What you see here is an opening that is very ambitious and somewhat vague. The attention of the society shall be directed to the improvement of horticulture. Okay, that's pretty all-encompassing. Ornamental is useful. And then we see that they had a very specific goal in mind, to promote which object, a garden, shall be established as soon as the funds will admit. They wanted to make a botanical garden. This would never happen. In order to create the garden, though, this new organization made a council of 12 people and named officers. They wrote bylaws. the kinds of things that nonprofit organizations rely on. And while they were trying to build a botanical garden, they did many other things. They had regular meetings. Members brought their produce, their plants, the things that they or their gardeners had grown in to show it off. Many folks who were members of the society held correspondence with people from around the world. That correspondence was read at these meetings. Every so often, there would be an exposition in which the public was invited to come and see the product of the members' gardens. And there was this idea of, again, of meeting a public need, but that just by inviting people in to see the plants, that would have a sort of trickle down educational value. That seeing flowers, that seeing fruits and vegetables would be edifying in and of itself. So to give you a sense of sort of how this early period of the society worked, I want to tell you a story about Caleb Cope and the Victoria Regia. So Caleb Cope was the president of PHS from 1841 to 1851. He was a very well-connected man even before he was the president of PHS. He had been the second in charge at the United States Bank. He was somebody with some social and economic heft in this town. And in 1851, shortly before he left his post as president of PHS, he received seeds for the Victoria Regia water lily from Kew Gardens in London. And he undertook the work to try to make it flower. Now, the Victoria Regia was a giant water lily. Let me find the dimensions here. The leaves were known to be 8 feet across, and the flower often a foot in circumference. And it was discovered by the English-speaking world in British Guiana in 1837, in the same year that Queen Victoria ascended to the throne. So it was named after her. And it became this symbol of British Empire, this massive flower that had been found in the colonies and was sort of exotic but also huge. And it became a national symbol. And they took seeds from those plants in Guyana and took them back to the United Kingdom, where they tried to propagate them. They successfully germinated seeds after a decade of work, but they couldn't get it to flower. Kew Gardens was racing against two other gardens who were throwing everything they could at it. Eventually, it was enticed to flower in 1849 with great expense and a steam-heated greenhouse. It was made to flower shortly before the 1851 Crystal Palace Exposition, which is when most of the public in the UK first got to see this flower, and it was right around that time that they sent those seeds to Caleb Cope. Now, there were seeds sent to Andrew Jackson Downing, too, the famous horticulturist. He was unsuccessful in his attempt to cultivate the flower. But Caleb Cope put a lot of resources behind this. Let me see if I can read off some of the things that he used here. He germinated the seeds, or rather his gardener, Thomas Ellis, germinated the seeds in loam and sand within a water tank situated in a greenhouse heated to between 85 and 95 degrees, imitating the tropical origins. Throughout the next months, PHS members received updates. The leaves are 3 inches, the leaves are 4 inches, etc. The entire enterprise really required a lot of fuel to heat the greenhouse, a lot of material, sand and loam had to be brought in. Cope only got the seeds because of his connection with PHS, and it also required round-the-clock tending by a gardener or a staff of gardeners, perhaps. And it earned both Cope and Ellis some acclaim. Cope got a prize. Ellis got a $25 prize from the PHS. Cope awarded Ellis a great honor by recommending him for membership in PHS. Up until that point, there was what was called a practical gardener's level of membership. It was cheaper than a normal membership, but it also came with some restrictions. A gardener like Ellis, probably couldn't afford a full membership, and he needed to be recommended anyway, which he was. So now it's 1850. In the late 19th century, PHS had a little wobble. A lot of things contributed to this. Industrialization took many of the folks who had been the lifeblood members of PHS out of the city. Their villa escapes became year-round housing. There were also other things. As silly as this sounds, recreational sports, such as golf and tennis, really took off in the late 19th century, and clubs for those sports provided an alternative kind of social engagement for people who would otherwise have been members of things like PHS. There was a little blip at the centennial in 1876 when PHS played host to horticulturalists from around the nation, but for the most part, it was at a sort of a low point. In 1867, however, some members went together and built Horticultural Hall. Not the one that was in Fairmount Park, one that was in the city. They had a bad history of fires with this building, rebuilt it several times. The president of PHS at the time, William Schaefer, dipped into his own funds to buy the building and keep them from foreclosing on the property. He rebuilt it after one of the fires. And shortly thereafter, in 1884, Schaefer died. His sister gave the property with the building on it to PHS. Another fire happened. PHS eventually sold that building in 1917, but the funds from that sale invested ensured an income for the organization of $20,000 each year for the next, I think, 20, 30 years, which gave a measure of stability. Now, in the early 20th century, we see the rise of the Philadelphia Flower Show as we know it. As I said, expositions of flowers and of fruit and vegetables had been part of PHS from the beginning, but it was only in the 20s, this picture is actually from the 40s, that the show grew to be anything remotely like what we know of it today. And it happened that way because a group of men, many of them florists or seed sellers, formed an organization called the Philadelphia Flower Show Incorporated. The PHS president at the time, James Boyd, the man who wrote the centennial history of the organization, was actually the first president of that organization, and he held that post while he was president of PHS as well. And Flower Show Incorporated really built the event into a powerhouse, into a spectacle. And let's see. Here's another picture. This is from 1952. On the right of this image is J. Lyddon Pennock Jr., who was, of the members of Flower Show Incorporated, one of the younger ones. What was really interesting reading the minutes of this organization is that many, many father and son pairs were involved in this organization, many of them juniors and seniors. It made a little confusing. So we had Alfred Campbell Sr., Alfred Campbell Jr., etc. But Lyddon Pennock would be a member of council of PHS from 1947 until 2002, with maybe a handful of years where he was not on council. He was a constant for the next 55 years. Also in this period, PHS modernized its bylaws. No longer did you need to be recommended for membership. They built many, many more committees, started doing more educational programming. James Boyd died in 1929. When he died, he was succeeded by C. Frederick C. Stout, who with John C. Wister formed a president and secretary combo of the PHS that would be in at the head of the organization for 21 years. Wister was secretary for 23. To that point, that was the longest reigning executive of the organization, and after Stout died, the bylaws were changed to put term limits on the president. That said, the partnership of Stout and Wister provided a lot of stability, and the organization built up its coffers so that by the 1950s, PHS was in a position to think about how it was doing what it was doing. And so 1958, there was a new committee was built, the Committee on New Activities. One of the recommendations of this committee was that PHS look beyond its members, that there was a public beyond the membership that needed to be served. This may have been an indication that PHS was noticing that the city of Philadelphia had changed around it. Philadelphia's population high was around 1950, and then it dropped for four decades. Only in the last 20 years or so has Philadelphia's population exceeded its 1950 population. There were a lot of complicated population trends that led to that. In the same year that the Committee on New Activities was initiated, PHS made a significant hire. The first staff person for PHS was the librarian back in the 19th century. In 1924, James Boyd had hired an executive secretary, not to be confused with the officer, the secretary. It was actually a staff person to run the administration of the organization. But in 1958, PHS hired its first salaried executive, Carlton Lees. They put out an ad for a horticulturist, asking that it preferably be a man, and they got one. He had some renown from his work at a horticultural society in Ohio. He stayed for 5 years, and then the Massachusetts Horticultural Society snatched him away. When they did, PHS turned to Ernesta Ballard. Yeah, let's give a clap for Ernesta. She's great. Ernesta was a graduate of the Pennsylvania Horticultural School for Women, which is now part of Temple University, part of the Ambler campus. She was a long-term PHS flower show volunteer. She had also written an acclaimed book on houseplants before they were cool. And she was offered the post, not of director, as Carlton Lees had been, but of executive secretary. And she was offered $2,000 less a year than he was. She walked away. Eventually, they would match his salary, but they would not give her his title. She was hired in 1963. It wasn't until 1970 that she was given the title of director, and not until 1973 when PHS would be reorganized and Ernesta Ballard would become president. And the head of council became the chairman of council rather than the president. This sort of followed an arc of professionalization of PHS. It wouldn't be too many years before the staff numbered in double digits. When Ernesta got the job, negotiations had long been underway for PHS to move buildings. And to move into Independence National Historic Park, which was being built, cleared, reconstructed at the time. the National Park Service had an official or unofficial policy that the only tenants that they were willing to rent to on park property had to have some connection to the 18th century. Well, PHS didn't. But the PSPA, the Philadelphia Society for Promoting Agriculture, did. And it was still around as a sort of a faint shadow of its former glory. They went in with PHS and shared offices. What that meant, essentially, my understanding is that the PSPA had one room that they used once a year. And when they weren't there, it was a PHS room. But that was how they got in. PHS also, in return, built what they called an 18th century garden that you can still see today next to what used to be their offices. When they moved in there, I believe that the staff numbered 6 people in 1964. We'll come back to that. In 1965, Flower Show Incorporated had a bit of a crisis. The venue for the flower show was going to be under construction, and it was expected to last for 2 years. They had had declining ticket rates. By one measure, the previous 11 years collectively had been at a loss of the Philadelphia Flower Show. And many of the men who had started the organization in the 20s were becoming quite elderly. Even their sons were becoming elderly. They decided to take a hiatus for a year. PHS, Ernesta Ballard, offered to have a flower show in their place, and they got the blessing of Flower Show Incorporated to do so in the armory of the First Troop, which was a relatively small venue. My understanding is that with extensive volunteer support, they actually managed to turn a profit that first year, which was really not expected. Because they had earned a profit even with all the adversity, PHS decided they wanted to do it the next year too. And construction of the Civic Center was continuing, and so Flower Show Incorporated was not going to have a show the next year either. They didn't feel great about PHS having another one, but they let them do it. Eventually, PHS kept the flower show. The reasons for that are a little complicated. They had to do with some key members of Flower Show Incorporated passing away in this period of time. They had to do with changing financial incentives, and they had to do with the fact that PHS, when it took over the flower show, offered a pretty good product. For one, they involved many more amateur gardeners than Flower Show Incorporated had. Flower Show Incorporated had long been sort of the purview of commercial gardens, and when PHS took over, they involved many, many more amateurs. Here's a nice picture of some of the flower show materials. I think that's a poster for the return to the Civic Center. And here's what that looked like. The first year that PHS was back in the Civic Center, they were limited to the lower level, the basement level, that's on the left. But one of the things that they did that Ernesta initiated that really turned the finances of the whole endeavor around was offering a preview night and a gala, which became a tremendous fundraiser for PHS. On the right is 1968, the grand opening of the flower show of 1968 in the main hall of the Civic Center, I believe. Now PHS faced another decision. They suddenly had funds in a way that they had not had before. When Ernesta was asked about this in 1994, she talked about it. She said, "It began with children. There's nothing more American than apple pie, motherhood, and children." And PHS started with very small investments in some children's summer camp gardens, in something called the Parkway Program, which was a classroom outside of the classroom program that was quite innovative and sort of spread to other cities. And finally, into some community gardens. Now, one of the reasons they went to community gardens was that other people were doing other sorts of gardening and greening. The Parks Department was doing what they called pocket parks in some empty lots, and PHS didn't want to step on toes. They didn't want to duplicate efforts. So what we have here in this picture, I'm trying to remember what year this is what do you say? 76-ish, yeah? The Garden Mobile, I think, started running around, what, 75? 75? What eventually happened was a program, by 1978, it would have a name, Philadelphia Green, but the first real summer was 1974, when the Bell Telephone Company gave significant funding. The Recreation Department gave some logistical support. And I believe 100 people gardened that summer. It was a relatively small year, but it was the beginning of a long-term sort of model of community gardening. Now, this was new for PHS, but it wasn't necessarily new for Philadelphia. As far back as the 1890s, the school garden movement had been really big in Philadelphia. The school garden movement put vegetable gardens in public schools, and they served various purposes. One, for kids who lived in homes with income insecurity, it provided dietary quality. They could take some produce home with them. Tuberculosis was a big problem, and fresh air was the number one way to combat it. So getting kids outside of the classroom worked to prevent the spread of tuberculosis. In the 1890s, there was also quite a lot of immigration into Philadelphia and the United States in general, and gardens were seen as a way to Americanize children. Okay, that movement sort of quickly swept into another one. In 1897, an economic crisis in Philadelphia spurred the creation of what was called the Philadelphia Vacant Lot Cultivation Association, which would run from 1897 to 1927, taking short-term loans of vacant land and farming to put many of the unemployed to work, as well as provide them with food. It was a time when there was a lot of vacant land, but it wasn't available for long-term development because it was held by speculators. So that's ended around the 1920s. Just as soon as that tradition was ending, other traditions were starting. Garden clubs swept the American suburbs in the mid-20th century. PHS got a massive boost in membership from some of those garden clubs. They were typically organized around both love of gardening, but also civic beautification in the suburbs, but also in urban settings. So one PHS member, Louise Bush Brown, who had actually run the Pennsylvania School of Horticulture for Women, organized what she called the Neighborhood Gardens Association, which from after her retirement in 1952 organized block by block beautification in several neighborhoods in Philadelphia. What eventually happened with Philadelphia Green is that it would join forces in 1978. It absorbed most of the Neighborhood Gardens Association, the community activists who were still involved with that. And what really made it more of a program than just ad hoc gardens was the infusion of federal funds in the form of block grants that the Philadelphia Office for Housing and Community Development acted as a pipeline for. That grant funding allowed PHS to hire four more horticulturalists and an assistant or a secretary, and gave Philadelphia Green a name. They actually had to move essentially across the street because there wasn't office space in that Independence National Historic Park building. When Edwin Peoples wrote his history of the PHS in 1977, he alluded to these kinds of urban outreach. He applauded Ernesta Ballard for her work in sort of enriching PHS, but he had really no idea how big Philadelphia Green would be over the next few decades. It was designed to spin off gardens so that when community gardens became self-sufficient, they would move under their own speed. That ensured, sort of acted as a brake against too much paternalism, I think, on the part of PHS. It was a supportive structure, but not an oppressive structure. But this program had a lot of value. By 1994, when participants, both PHS employees and community gardeners, talked about the program, they identified pretty wide-ranging benefits. For one, they facilitated intercultural, interracial conversations that wouldn't otherwise have happened. By the 1970s, the city of Philadelphia was something like 49% non-white racially, whereas the surrounding counties were under 10% non-white. The city had a poverty rate of about 15%, whereas the surrounding counties had a poverty rate of about 5%. So some of the PHS members and PHS staff really interacted with people they never would have interacted with otherwise. For the folks living in these communities, there were other kinds of intercultural benefits. Many folks who were immigrants learned how to exist in the city through their relationships with their neighbors. And the gardens also became essentially de facto community hubs. They weren't just talking about what to plant, they were talking about whether the trash was getting picked up, as one person said in an oral history in 1994. They were talking about whether there was graffiti on the walls. One partner of some of these projects was the Philadelphia Anti-Graffiti Network, now Mural Arts, and worked to paint murals in some of these garden spaces. By the late 70s, the model changed somewhat. Many of the gardens that were participating with Philadelphia Green were clustering geographically, and in order to facilitate broader greening in those neighborhoods, Philadelphia Green adopted a model that they called the Green Country Towns, by which neighborhoods could apply to be essentially model neighborhoods, and greening would take place not only in gardens, but also in planters, and also in other kinds of vacant land clearing. That program essentially lasted from the early 80s to the early 90s, and had probably an even broader impact than some of the community gardening efforts previously. By 1989, other methods of greening were coming in, and PHS tried some of them out. One of those was the idea of cleaning and greening, of taking a vacant lot, perhaps filled with rubble or refuse, clearing it, planting grass, and moving on, and counting on the community to use the space. By 1999, it was a more formalized program. By 2003, it had a name, LandCare. And this program, which if you have driven through several neighborhoods of Philadelphia, you surely have seen the the fences, fenced off blocks with grass and trees planted. Had a lot to recommend it. For one, it meant it was accomplished through the Office of Licenses and Inspections directly, so that residents of the neighborhood did not have to apply to the city for specific use of the block. It was streamlined through PHS. And neighbors could use it however they wanted, really. I am struggling to come up with a number, but there's something like, I think it's on the order of 70,000 cleared lots. Maybe that's 10 years old information, I don't know. It's made a big impact on the city. And that program is ongoing today. Okay, I'm gonna wrap up here a little bit. Here we have the 1978 strategic plan mission. One of the interesting things I have found as I went through the archives is the ways in which the mission changed. So the 1978 mission switched to the purposes of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society are to collect and disseminate information about horticulture, to inspire a taste for horticultural knowledge, and to make that knowledge available to as many people as possible. We'll see another one here in a moment. So here we have a green country town. Point Breeze was one of the seven green country towns. Here we have a staff photo from, I believe, the 1986 yearbook. One of the notable things here is that this was the PHS staff by 1986. Had grown somewhat since 1964. In 1996, PHS finally moved out of Independence National Historic Park and out of the Civic Center as the site for the flower show. In that same year, they switched locations both for their office and for their flagship event, which caused ripple effects, but also provided another possibility, an opportunity for thinking through what the future could hold. In the 1999 strategic plan, this is the mission that was created. And I think this is very similar to what the current mission is. The Pennsylvania Horticultural Society motivates people to improve the quality of life and create a sense of community through horticulture. And internal documents of the time note that the use of horticulture at the end of the sentence was intentional, that horticulture was to be a means to an end rather than an end in and of itself. Okay, that's all I have for today. We'll be doing a Q&A, I believe. Do we have time for that? No? Okay. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
All right.
Yep.
Thank you, Ted. The reception's still open across the hall. Ted, can you hang around for reception? So grab him with questions, and thank you again for being part of our story. Have a good night.
Thank you.